Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. We've learned about some big literary awards this week. The Pulitzer Prizes were awarded on Monday, and Colson Whitehead won in the fiction category for Underground Railroad. Hisham Mattar won for autobiography with The Return, and you've heard them both on this show. Over the weekend, the Minnesota Book Awards were handed out. You can see the full list of winners at nprnews.org/thread. We'll spend the rest of this hour with one of them. It's Peter Guy and his novel about the power and the draw of the North Woods. Let's listen back to a show from last summer when we went in depth on wintering. There's a nostalgic quality to the setting that Peter Guy has returned to in his newest novel, and perhaps you understand that after gathering your family around at a northern Minnesota cabin or a favorite resort over the 4th of July weekend. Think of how we embroider those childhood memories of long days at the lake and how they shimmer in our imaginations. Peter said recently that he returns to the landscape of northern Minnesota because, quote, the nature of this place, of its changeability, makes the characters who inhabit it seem larger and more complicated. And the complications abound in his new novel. As he joins us, I'd like you to think about your most singular memory of northern Minnesota. I think Peter and I would be interested in hearing that. Maybe it was with a parent or a close friend. And this experience is something that informs who you are today. So think about this for a bit as we begin our conversation. And talk to me this morning about that most singular memory of an experience in northern Minnesota. Was it with your family? Was it with your partner? Is it something that really influences who you turned out to be, who you are today? Okay, here's the number on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis hanging out at nprnews.org/live. And I'm on Twitter. Okay, 140 characters of an influential memory in northern Minnesota, but you can do it if you put your mind to it. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Peter Guy's new novel is part of our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series, and I'm glad it is because I love the book. It's called Wintering, and he joins me in the studio. And welcome. Long time to have you coming here, and I'm really glad you're here.
I'm delighted to be here. Yeah.
So do I sense a kind of nostalgic longing in these settings that you've come back to again in this novel, but I know in which you've placed other novels?
I think so. I mean, I don't know if I'd exactly describe it as nostalgia, because my trips there and adventures there don't exactly jive with my characters' trips and adventures there. Mine are mostly wonderful memories. I don't know that I'd say the same for most of the characters. But,
fair enough.
But I do return there, and return there, by there I mean the North Shore. I return there often as I can, and it is always with the sort of longing that's something like nostalgia. Yeah,
that longing. So, mm-hmm. So that's what I read in kind of the subtext of these beautiful descriptions. Fair enough that you haven't lived out the plots of your novels.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd expect that. But this underlying, there's kind of a yearning.
Well, there
to that
is,
place.
And I think. Well, I guess now that I say that, I think back to my earliest memories of the place, and I wouldn't say they're fraught, but they're definitely full of powerful memories. You know, most of them have to do with my family, with my dad especially. Our first trip to Lake Superior that I remember, our first trip into the Boundy Waters that I remember. In fact, just recently he gave me the map of our first trip when I was 10 years old that we took into the Boundy Waters.
What's it look like?
It looks like any map that you use to go into the Boundy Waters, except it has marked on it all our camp spots and all the places that we visited on that first trip. And I remember, I think some of the things about that trip. I definitely remember some of the anticipation of that trip. I don't know that I'm exactly true in my memories. We took many of these trips, many, I don't even know how many trips into the Boundy Waters. And so probably it's a composite memory that I'm recalling and not that particular trip. But there's something entangled in all of that that's true of nostalgia. But I do think of it more as longing. Yeah.
You know, you've just kind of touched on something that that I think about. I grew up on a lake in western New York, not all that different from the landscape of Minnesota. And I'm often asking myself, as I think about those memories, am I burnishing them as an, you know, I'm on the lookout for mm-hmm. that. Yes, I want them to be meaningful childhood memories, but am I embroidering a lot of stuff around them that if I tell my mother, well, this is what I remember, she'll say, well, that's not really that. No, you've mashed a whole bunch of summers together yeah. in that memory. You do that?
I'm certain that I do. I'm certain that we all do. But one of the good things about having, well, my father is now in his mid-70s. So when he used to be the one to tell me that I was mixing things up, but now because he's a little bit older, yeah. I can tell him he's mixing it up. I think it's absolutely true. I mean, whether we're talking about the memories of our childhood and where we grew up, or the memories of where we had dinner last week and what conversations we had around the table, they get complicated and they get muddled and they disappear right. and we invent things to go along right. with them. We right. want them to be better memories or worse memories, depending on what the situation was. And it's just unavoidable in our life. And it's that sort of quality of the ephemeral nature of our memories is one of the big stories in this book, one of the big themes in this book.
I mean, the other thing I can see you exploring is how a mythology in a family mm-hmm. happens, right? Yeah. It's the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and how everybody kind of contributes to that mythology. And then how some of that changes as you age and you start to see your parents more as individuals and not just your parents.
Right.
You were exploring some of that, weren't you?
Absolutely. And I think that, like our memories, is something that's just constantly evolving. You know, our relationships with our parents and with our siblings and with the people that we love, our children, it's constantly evolving. And in that evolution, it seems to me that, we lose a lot. We gain a lot by what we add to it, but we lose a lot by what we just can't remember.
Yeah, what do you think gets lost in the creation of the myth of whatever family you're
yeah.
in?
Well, I mean, certainly a lot of the particular details, right? You know, I mean, I think about when my children were born, and I replay those memories now, certain things are inviolable. You know, I mean, they absolutely happened, but so many things didn't happen. And so many of the most sort of dreamlike memories become more and more dreamlike all the time, even as sure of them as I am. So I used to walk my kids to sleep at night when they wake up in the middle of the night. And, you know, I mean, certainly I did that. I did that, and I sang to them, and I read to them. But in my memory, you know, they were the holiest nights of my life. And I think in reality, I was probably pulling my hair out and screaming at them, wanting them to go to bed. And
exactly.
So I think that happens. And I don't think it's a bad thing that it happens. I don't think we're not in some way compromising our past by remembering it that way. It's just part of how the mind works. And I'm not an expert on the human mind. But I do spend probably more time thinking about memories and thinking away about the ways that we mythologize our lives and our families and our ancestors' lives than most people.
You know, I was just thinking that story of you walking your kids overnights when they wouldn't sleep. I mean, people probably wouldn't have children if there was not some mythology about the idea of raising children, right? Because if it was all just real, and this is how hard it is every minute of mm-hmm. every day for the mm-hmm. first 5 years,
yeah.
we need that.
We absolutely do. And what we also need is people to stop saying it's going to be some other way. My sister has
exactly.
a couple of young kids, and she was just here over the holidays, and I was watching her just exhausted, you know, chasing them around and constantly intending. My kids are not old. My youngest is 6 years old. So it's not like they're taking care of themselves yet, but it's a whole different ballgame when you have a 3-year-old than when you have, you know, kids who it is possible for them to open the box of Cheerios themselves.
Let me grab a call here from Sandy, listening on the road. Hi, Sandy. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Sherry. Thank you.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about when my father took me on canoe trips when I was about in junior high age. And, of course, it was incredibly beautiful, and it was so clean that we could, you know, dip a ladle into the lake and drink from it. But it was this extreme sense of independence that I got, because before we left, we had to lay out what we wanted to bring, and we had to carry it on our backs. So you couldn't bring it unless you wanted to carry it. And then you know, you had to fish to get your dinner, you had to pitch your tent, you had to paddle all day, you had to help carry the boat. And by the time I was done, I just had this sense of strength that I carried, you know, into my life from that moment forward. So I wasn't even nervous to go off to college, for example, because I knew I was strong and independent and I could figure it out.
Boy, I am so glad you called. What a great memory. You know, Peter, what she's saying, I couldn't help but when she was talking about how they had to lay out their things and they had to think about every little thing that they would take. That, as you created the beginning of this novel and this idea that this father and son are going off into the wilderness, you thought pretty carefully about that.
I did, yeah. And, you know, I think that it is sort of a perfect call to start with, because that sense of independence that you get from an experience like visiting the Boundary Waters it's incredibly powerful, and it can inform so much of your life. And I do think of the many experiences that I myself have had there and the ways that that has prepared me for the rest of the world and the rest of the challenges that I've been faced with. And I resort to those memories and those feelings of like being empowered and being emboldened all the time. I really do. And in fact, I sort of think of it sometimes in the context of my work, in the context of my writing. Mm. Like, you can do it, you know, like you have done that 248 rod portage. You can do this, finish this paragraph, you know.
The other thing that comes to mind with what Sandy's describing is you are making decisions about what you'll deny yourself, right? There mm-hmm. are some things you yeah. cannot carry yep. into yep. that place. So you're already anticipating there will be things that don't comfort you, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have to cope with that.
Absolutely, yeah. And for some people, that I guess it makes them uncomfortable. You know, you right. don't get your cot to sleep on. You don't get your fancy 48-piece lawn chair to sit in. But for me and for the characters in this book, certainly, those living without those things is one of the joys and one of the pleasures of an experience like this. And that's why I think not everyone wants to visit the Boundary Waters. You know, there are.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm going to get hate mail here, but I've never been to the Boundary Waters. Yeah, no. Yeah, no don't know if I'm up to the bugs.
Those are not daggers I'm staring across the desk at you. I think that, you know, it isn't a trip for everyone, but it is can be certainly an informative experience. You asked earlier about what they bring into the, yeah. you know, in the planning that goes into this trip. And one of the things, and they're certainly careful about it, you know, Harry and Gus, the two protagonists of the book.
Father and son,
yep. But they're also, I don't know, they're not quite as thorough as I would be. Certainly not as thorough as my own father would be. And that's one of the things, I guess, that inspires or encourages hopefully a little bit of the tension in the story is their outfit complete? Have they been as careful as they can be, and do they have everything that they need? Because where they're going, you know, they're going in winter, so it's going to be much harder to fish. It's going to be much harder to keep warm. They're not going to have the bugs to worry about, as you say, but they'll have some other things to worry about. And have they taken care of themselves?
Did your dad give you that old map before he read this novel or after?
Oh, no, much later than when he read the novel. I suppose he read this book for the first time a couple of years ago.
And he just gave you the map?
Yeah. I think he was cleaning out a closet
really?
Or something. Who knows what he was doing?
Because maps are a deal yeah. in this novel.
Yes, and in my life. And I think, and probably they are a deal in my life because they're a deal in his life. I mean, the fact that he still has this map and that it's still marked is... I don't think insignificant to my life or his. But I wish I'll have to ask him
how he dug that out.
Yeah, where he got it.
Let's grab a call to Mark in Moorhead. Hi, Mark.
Still there?
Yeah. Hey, go right ahead. Good to have
your
call.
Thank you for taking the call. Long-time
sure.
listener. But I just got a question when I was listening, Carrie, and you mentioned a mythology. And I'm not sure it's a mythology. I think we're looking for values all the time in our life. And when you talked about walking his baby and comforting in the middle of the night, but he's probably pulling his hair out trying to get her to bed. But as you look back, those are values in terms of caring for this little one and doing those things. I remember my father years and years ago, a much older father, but he talked about losing three of his siblings, and he was the oldest child. And you know, sat with them and cared for them during that time. And I remember sitting with him after he died. Very difficult time. I spent time, you know, after my dad had passed away and sat with him. But I look back on that was difficult, but that's a real treasured time. All those things are. I mean, and so I think it's not mythology as much as it is as we look at value. All those things I pulled my hair out when my kids were little, now I look back, are very little value to me in comparison to them.
Yeah.
Or in comparison to nurturing and caring for them. So I don't know if it's mythology or if we look for value. What's truly important? Where do we spend our time? Where do we invest ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peter, what would you say?
I mean, I think that it can be both things. I think that, of course, we're talking about values on the one hand, but in the context of my work and in even in my own family, I think that this is true. I'm sort of constantly reinventing what has happened with my own family, both with my kids and with my siblings and my parents. And I think that that reinvention and the fact that it's a reinvention built around these, you know, sort of suspect memories, I don't know, I do think that it lends itself a little bit to a mythology. And I mean, maybe as a, you know, if we're being perfectly semantically correct, then no, it's not a mythology, but it's something like a mythology that we're creating.
We said earlier that there are places that you, where there are spaces that you tend to fill in with. I mean, we all do this with imagination and some longing, and this is what I wanted it to mean to me. And so, you know, I think of it a little bit as putting some putty into these open spaces around that memory, and now then that holds it all together.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that's true is that when we're talking now, I mean, I'm talking about my parents and my siblings. So these are people that I'm intimate with, of course. But there's another quality to my thinking, to the way that I live my life, but also to the work that I do. And that's, we're going back generations to figure out who we are, or to hopefully figure out who we are. And in my own case, I know a little bit about my ancestry, but not very much. And I've sort of decided that I wouldn't learn so much about my ancestry because I want the flexibility in my imagination to invent them, which is maybe the writer in me talking. I want to be able to imagine whatever I want to about them. I know, for example, that my maternal grandmother lived on a farm in North Dakota and used to milk the cows, and her father used to milk the cows. But I don't know much more about them.
And that's enough for you.
And that's enough for me. And in fact, I've sort of gone out of my way to avoid it because I have cousins who have done the work. I could go on Ancestry.com and figure out everything that I ever wanted to know about them and have resisted doing that. And I don't, maybe someday if I get smarter or something, I'll figure it out and want to go back there. But I don't want to go back there now. And part of the reason is, to go back to this idea of mythology, I mean, I kind of want to be able to imagine my family how I want to imagine my family. I don't know how much good it's going to do to find out that that guy who milked the cows was some terrible man. So
Peter Guy is in the studio with us, and we're talking about his new novel, Wintering. I loved it. It's a Take It to the Lake summer fiction part of our series. And one of the ideas that we're talking about with this novel, it's set in the Boundary Waters in the winter landscape. And it really made me think about singular experiences in places that are really important to us. And because it's set in northern Minnesota, that's what we're talking about today. And maybe that experience for you was with a parent, or a sibling, or a close friend, somebody that you ended up sharing your life with. But often I think we're going to hear about parents, right? Those experiences with our parents. If you have one, join in. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR, where Tom says, "The expanse, depth, and beauty of Lake Superior mirrors my own expanse, depth, and beauty. Longing finds its home." And step off the page.
Peter says, "I grew up on Sullivan Lake outside of Brainerd in a cabin with knotty pine and no TV. At 7, I drove a 14-foot fishing boat to visit my friends. By 8, I took the boat with my friends to an island through a channel to Platte Lake, and we played on an island. We came home for lunch when we heard a bell ring."
That sounds idyllic, doesn't it?
A way of life that's not so common anymore, right?
Geez. Brian on Twitter, sitting in the Raven's Nest in downtown Grand Marais and a 70-degree evening, drinking a beer and watching the harbor with friends. And to Andy in Brooklyn Center. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Hi.
So my, I guess I had sort of a full circle experience that started with a singular experience when I visited Lake Superior with my family. I was probably about 10 or 11 years old. And I guess I wasn't real well traveled. I hadn't seen the ocean yet. I hadn't seen the mountains. And so to see something so magnificent, I just remember feeling kind of small and humble in a good way. And then many years later, I returned with my college girlfriend, and eventually we became married, and we were engaged on the shores of Lake Superior.
Wow.
And so now, you know, we enjoy returning with our own children, and it was just kind of cool with both of our boys to experience their first sighting of Lake Superior. So it's just has a special place in our lives.
That full circle quality, yeah, Peter really gets that too, mm-hmm. don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my kids are crazy about it. They think that the beach in front of Lutzen Resort is like Cancun or something. They dive into the water as soon as they get there, and I'm proud of that. I like that about my kids, and I think that it's true for a lot of families. You know, I mean, most of us here in, you know, in Minnesota and in the Twin Cities, we know all about Lake Superior, and we know all about everything about it, how cold it is, how big it is, how stormy it can be, the ships, the Edmund Fitzgerald, and all of this, all of those sorts of mythologies about the lake. But I don't know that that's true for most other people. I remember,
you mean that aren't from Minnesota?
Right.
No,
yeah.
I didn't know anything about it until I moved here.
I think that one of the reasons that I decided to start writing about it is because I felt like it deserved a sort of audience unto itself, you know, like this Lake Superior, there's a map right behind you, Carrie, and it's right there. You know, it's a huge part of who we are and a huge part of our identity as a state. And it's something that so many people don't know about. And certainly if they might know it on a map, but they don't know what it's like to stand there on a November day when there's, you know, 20-foot waves coming ashore. And they don't know about how cold it is to walk in up to your ankles and feel your feet freeze in the first couple of minutes that you're in the water. And those qualities about the lake and just the sort of the depth of it, the majesty of it, are what drew me in the first place and would draw me back time and time again.
I want to ask you about decisions around who the narrators of the story would be, because you made an interesting choice. As we've noted, the story is about a father and a son who, with a history behind them, who go up into the boundary waters, into the wilderness in winter for a trip that's kind of open-ended, right? No word. They haven't made a decision about when they'll be coming back. But you create this voice of Barrett. She's the older woman to whom the son is telling the story of that first trip.
She's not only the woman to whom the son is telling the story, but the woman that Harry was in love with for the last half of his life.
The
Harry
father.
Being the father.
Right.
Yeah. Or the last third of his life, anyway.
And she's such a... I was struck by this from the first sentence of the novel. She's such a trusted voice to me. And maybe it has something to do with the first sentence, which I thought I would just read. She says, "Our winters are faithful and unfailing, and we take what they bring. But this season has tested even the most devout among us." I can't say why, but I knew I was in good hands with her.
I can't say why either. I can tell you that it took me a long time to find Barrett.
That's what I wanted to know.
I spent, I don't know, this is like a fish story. I probably only did 4 or 5 versions of the first 50 pages of this book, even though in my memory it seems like 20 versions. And the whole time I was trying to, well, do two things: figure out who she was, who this woman was, and also what her voice would sound like to me. And this is a sort of inside baseball thing, but as an author, I need to hear the voice. And I don't mean literally hear it, but when I'm rereading what I've written, I need to know that I can trust that I can sustain her voice. I need to be in love with her voice. I want to be devoted to her because I expect her to be devoted to me. And I knew that it was going to be a woman. I thought maybe it would be Harry's wife. I thought maybe it would be Harry's daughter. I thought maybe it would be Rebecca Grimm, who's a character from the previous book, The Lighthouse Road, that also shows up in this book. And I thought also that it might be a couple other women like Barrett. But once I settled on her voice and on her character, it was like lightning. You know, I mean, it just became so much easier and so much more organic. And I didn't feel like I was struggling against the voice and against the character. I felt like she was working with me. I felt like she was right along with me. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. In retrospect, I can see a lot of things about her that are interesting to me. And I identify with her in ways that I don't usually identify with characters. I mean, it might seem like because I'm a guy and because I've spent all this time in the Boundary Waters, I'd be more in line with Gus or Harry. But it's not true. I identify way more with Barrett and with her sort of her patience and her own longing and her own, I don't want to say confusion, but mystification at what has happened in her life. And those qualities of hers are qualities that I adore in people. And I guess that I feel like I understand them in myself a little bit.
Have you, it's interesting to hear you say, I didn't feel like I was struggling against the voice, which makes me wonder if you've been through writing experiences where it was hard. You were pushing up against the voice through the writing.
Absolutely. And I think the longer I do this, that is, the longer I write books, the more essential that companionship with the character or with the voice, it becomes more and more essential. And I don't know why that is. And maybe that will change again by the time I start the next book or finish the next book, because things don't tend to stay the same for me in terms of how I relate with the characters and how I interact with them. It's constantly changing. But certainly in this case, and in the case of the last couple of books as well, it's been really important to me. It's been probably the most important part of it.
The companionship
yes,
of the
I know
voice.
What's going to happen in the story. I, you know, not everything, but I have a sort of idea about what the story is about. And I have an idea about, you know, what's going to happen and who's going to love who and, you know, what the lake is going to look like in particular scenes or what the wilderness is going to look like in other scenes. But until I feel that intimacy with the characters, especially the voice, it can be tough going. Absolutely.
I mean, again, interesting to hear you say it's become the most important thing. I mean, do you think some of that is experience and maturity as a writer to say, I know what to do with this now? I mean, that kind of companionship gives me the kind of freedom that I now know what to do with because I've done this before.
I do think that that's true. I also think that one of the large questions that always involves finding that voice is finding out the point of view. You know, whether or not it would have been just as easy to tell this story from the third person point of view. But for me, so much of what happens in a story like Wintering, and same with my last book, The Lighthouse Road, depends on that point of view. Characters interacting with the story as it's told, stories within stories. And to me, and these are my favorite sorts of books to read, which is maybe why I write them like this as well, that just brings more and more meaning. And the dynamics, it's sort of like family dynamics, you know, the different
That's
qualities,
true.
You know.
But Peter, it also brings complexity. I mean, you were time shifting within scenes, just as you say, story within a story, which is making it more complex, which is why, in a way, this is for a more experienced, mature writer.
It is. But when I think about my previous books, they all involve stories within stories. And I'm not sure if this is probably, there's probably some clinical writer's clinical definition of what's wrong with me. But I'm sort of, I guess it's just how I think about fiction and how it seems to make the most sense to me and how it works the best for me.
I think it seems, I will say this, that time shifting scene within stories within scenes felt the real way that you would tell a complicated story to someone, where you never tell things chronologically to someone. There's tangents and there's a layer. And then, oh, I have to tell you about this too.
Well, that's exactly the way we live our lives. I mean, this is happening right now. We're sitting here talking. But now, what I just said is not part of now.
Yeah.
And now it's not again. And so it just keeps happening that way. And this is not, I mean, I'm certainly not the first person that ever thought of this, but I become preoccupied with this idea about how much of our lives is behind us or ahead of us. I mean, there's a lot of looking forward in this book as well.
That's right.
Anticipating things, wanting things, longing for things. You can long for the past just as much as you can long for the future. But this moment that we're living in now, the story of right now, this is the current moment, is already gone again. And I think that because that's how life is, and that's true, like, second by second and minute by minute, but it's also true when I go to bed at night, I'm not thinking about falling asleep right now. I'm thinking about what happened during the day or what's going to happen tomorrow. And so much of life is lived in those moments before and after the now, that it seems like all of life is lived that way.
I know, but then the challenge is to understand and cherish the now,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, it is.
Don't you ever say to yourself, I do this a lot, slow it down.
Oh, yeah.
This is a moment you don't want to kind of drift off without mm-hmm. noticing it.
Yeah. I don't think that you're necessarily compromising the now, because there's the linear life that we're living, but there's also who we are becoming. That's a sort of a shadow person or something, and who we want to be and the things that we want to accomplish in life or savor in life or get rid of in life. They're all like in a suitcase next to us, and we're carrying that all along with us. And that suitcase becomes part of who we are as well. And in fact, maybe the main part of who we are is in that suitcase. And that is the memories that we have and the things that we have to look forward to
as
well.
That's a good way to think about it. To Carol in Fergus Falls. Hi, Carol. Hey, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. We had a wonderful family place up in just outside the Boundary Waters, and my husband did his research on dragonflies up there, and he left his spot. And 20 years later, after we were married and had children in their 10, 12, we took him up there to that site, and the wood was still there that he had left when he left the place for the research.
Wow.
And the boys got to burn their dad's wood in the fireplace.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Uh-huh.
And we still, that's a favorite family place that we go to often in camp. And we don't tell anybody where it is because it's so special. And it's just a wonderful, lots of wonderful family memories. And we boys are adults now, and they still do lots of camping.
So not even for us, Carol, will you tell us where it is? I'll take that as a no.
That's a no. But I'm really enjoying your talk here.
I'm glad.
And listening to all the memories and things that he's talking about and how special it is with your children and growing up.
I'm glad you were listening, Carol.
I love that idea of going back to burn the firewood that the father collected 20 years before. I mean, that's just exactly the sort of thing that I'm talking about. That wood sat there for all those 20 years, and can you imagine how well it burned?
I know.
You know?
Yeah. Gray says on Twitter, BWCA, Portage, sitting, getting a picture taken. Photog says, bear behind you. Turn, look, yes, there's a bear. He sniffed and left. Lesson equals BO protects. Ah, the body odor. Scared away the bear. Steph off the page.
Megan says, as a Canadian transplant to Minnesota, our trips every year to the northern part of the state brings us closer to our origins and makes Minnesota feel like home. Think moss-covered rocky shorelines, scent of pine needles warmed by the sun, and horseflies.
the horseflies. See the bugs. I mentioned this, Peter. We're going to close with some Voyageurs music. And you, boy, this story is laced with a lot of these songs. How did you know about them?
I read about them in Grace Lee Knute's book, The Voyager. And in fact, if I have just a couple of seconds
to tell
a story. So a couple weeks ago now, I launched the book in town here. And one of my best friends, a man named Mike Lamb, who's a guitarist and, as it turns out, a mandolin player as well, he joined me, and he performed three of the chansons from the book. Yeah,
really.
I mean, he did he performed the whole songs, and it was just simply one of the most beautiful things that I've ever been a part of, and not at all how I imagined the songs being played in the book. Much more beautiful than that. But I love music and novels and in life, I guess in life more than in novels. And those chansons, which were such a part of the Voyager experience, they sang all day.
I was a little loud there, but Peter, thank you. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Gary.
The book is called Wintering, and yes, it is full of chansons. Here's the Voyager's music. wintering part of our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series. You can find all the books that I'm reading and talking about on the thread, nprnews.org/thread.